Have you ever heard of the musical The Puppet's Regime? Most likely you haven't. I mean, in fact, even some hardcore musical lovers often don't know the story of this little production. It was a 1934 stage musical written by anonymous authors of music, lyrics, and book. It starred upcoming performers such as Timmy Cutie Pie Wright, Sally Wilkes, Henry Gregory, as well as many others. At the time, it was the most expensive show to that date. It was said to be the biggest, most spectacular show you'd ever see. I've actually compiled a couple different research articles. From the Testament of Tyler Warwick, 1901 to 1983, I went to see the show when I was about a week after I turned about 33. The ticket was a gift from my sister, who knew how much I loved musicals. I remember the signs. They were huge. I also remember the playbill. It was just a single red dot with a doll-like face on it. Didn't make much sense to me, but it didn't matter, because I was going to see a Broadway show. From the Testament of Georgina Long, the cast was made completely of new people, kids and adults, who were longing to get back on the stage after vaudeville stopped being popular. It was quite charming, really. I do remember how odd the whole thing was. All the playwrights and lyricists, and everyone, were all unnamed. That playbill. It was like a red drop. A peculiar little face on it. Not even a title. Just the little red dot. I had come to New York with my parents to cheer the family up after my grandmother had died. A Broadway musical seemed to be just what they needed. From the Testament of Carl Hannigan, I remember the first act. Then again, who could forget? The story was a little hard to follow at first. There was a little boy who lived in a puppet shop. Or maybe he lived down the street. No, he lived in a puppet shop. But he was homeless, so they provided him a home there. And the kid's name was Mortim, something weird. Oh yeah, it was Moriatum. Moriator. Yeah, Moriator. Anyway, Moriator's employer, the old man named Mr. Obisker. I remember his name because he was so creepy. I think his character was a pedophile. The two of them sang this weird song about puppets. It wasn't a normal song, right? At least the music was normal. And the lyrics were very exciting. The music did this odd thing where the high notes and low notes sort of mixed with each other. It really set the strange mood, but we thought nothing of it. The show progressed. Testament, Gabriel Johnson. This little kid, Moriator, something like that, had a girlfriend named Trahunt, and this other boyfriend named Adelbit. And together, they talked about how much they loved puppets, and so they sang this cute little song about joining forces to raise money so they could afford to buy their own puppet. And something really odd happened in the story. The three all headed for school, and they had really nasty teachers named Madame Ruperio, or something like that. And they had a reprise to the song from before she overheard them. At first, her remarks about the children's fantasies were somewhat comical. And then the light fixed on her, and she sang this heartbreaking little song about... Well, that was up for interpretation. It was somewhat about love. But it had these strange puppet metaphors. Then she went on this little breakdown. We thought that it was a strange character trait. She started singing off key, went to beat one of the children, and the curtain fell. There was a scuffle heard on stage, and we sort of dismissed it, though. So soon the curtain rose again, and we were back at the puppet shop. From the Testament of Lewis Roberts, 1905 to 1967. Moriator and his friends went to town and sang a song about selling dolls, I think it was, because the little girl had made dolls in her spare time, and she had to sell them. I remember those strange background characters. The company was so absolutely monotonous. They all wore some dark clothing, and each of them were very, very tall. I can remember how they all had their faces covered up by their hair or hats or veils. None of them spoke. None of them even sang during the course of the show. They just walked in perfect straight lines, as if they weren't even part of the show. Anyway, this strange song about buying dolls, it had absolutely no life. But for some strange reason, these kids were putting their all into it. I mean, I could see the pain on their faces as they hit those high notes. Something else. As the lyrics went on, they seemed to get a little... It's hard to explain. They all looked like they were... like, dying a little on the inside. They looked so pale and nervous all of a sudden. Honestly, it made me a bit anxious. From the testament of Carrie Laurie. The kids all got their money from the strange man in a cloak who sang a simple little tune, and I still remember the lyrics. Despite the fall of rain, little kitties, everyone needs a little song. Wooden dolls give you pain, little kitties. Go on, little kitties. Run along. His character was never really explained, but I remember how truly gripped the melody was. So haunting. It got you right there in the gut. I mean, even the little kid actors seemed a bit unsettled by the new tune of the show. They all kept stuttering over their lines. They spoke and sang, and I still remember when a light bulb over the stage went out. Everyone kind of gasped, and one man, I think, even laughed. It really spooked the little girls. Little Miss, what's her name? And all the names were so odd. I mean, all I know is the light bulb had gone out, and the actors were stumbling across the stage, and the whole thing looked like a terrible flop. From the Testament of Marcus Edgar, 1918-1968. So after the light bulb went out, the whole set started falling apart. We, the audience, tried our best to ignore it. We found it near impossible. The set pieces for the puppet shop screeched its way onto the stage. We could see it in the far back, the paper sky background falling down, and the light went dim in what we assumed was an attempt to hide the malfunctioning set pieces, and the kids, with the help of an oddly monotonous Mr. Abiskar, constructed the puppet. And, this weird song played. To this day, I don't know what they were saying. It sounded somewhat like Latin. But I went on to study Latin in college the next year and found it to be no way the language. I remember how it enchanted me, though. It enchanted all of us. We all began to feel this thing course through us. I remember a few people around us who were all humming in an attempt to rid themselves of the sound, and I could hear people in the front rows crying out in what sounded like pain. The actors themselves sounded as though they were all about to pass out at any moment. They were doing this odd sort of ballet, tripping all over themselves, and I could remember a few more lights flashing, breaking. We all sat, waited for the song to end, and I'm sorry. I can't. From the Testament of George Frank. The lights were going on and off at random, and we were all praying the damn song would end soon. And it had this force going with it. It was sucking us in. We could feel it. The little kids and Puppet Man were dancing all around when you see... From the Testament of Carolyn Mark, the lights were completely out of control. It was a mess, and that song, it was awful. But something about it, it was powerful. powerful. It had force. I watched intently as the dancers began to skip around and I thought they were the lights. The actual events of the final scene of Act 1 of the Puppet Master's regime has been up for debate for many years, and not many people are willing to speak out about what happened on stage during those final scenes. Many believe that there is no actual record of an interview with somebody who's willing to tell the story. But that's not true. As one testament survives from Billy Prescott, who was only 6 at the time of the show. At such a young age, one might assume he was unaffected by what he recalls happening. I don't remember a lot because I was just a kid. All I can remember is that song. It was giving me a headache. I turned to my father to ask him if I could leave, when suddenly I saw the stage illuminate with this red light. The music stopped as one instrument after another died out, and I swear I heard pounding underneath the stage. Everyone was questioning what was happening, even the actors. I remember that teacher lady being pushed through the door to the shop, and some assembly members ran on stage for some reason and just stopped. I remember a few people started crying right there on the stage. Suddenly this curtain came forward. It's hard to describe what it looked like. It was a clear plastic wall. It came down from above. Several years later, I saw Carrie the Musical on Broadway during one of its few runs. That thing that came down on the promgoers when Carrie was using laser lights to kill everyone. It was just like that. A bunch of set pieces from the earlier scenes came down on the stage, trapping all the actors in the center, and then chaos erupted. The actors were pounding on the plastic wall thing when suddenly the curtain flew out and left us all in the dark, and the audience at the time thought that it was just a really twisted ending to a terrible musical, and we were all about to get up when suddenly the curtain opened up again, revealing a single light. And in it was the little boy, Moriator. He had clawed his way through the plastic wall. We could see this blood on his hands, but I remember how he looked. There was this strings attached to every part of his body, like a puppet. Not only that, but we could see his stomach. A lack of anything. It was like somebody had put a huge ice cream scoop in his belly, and he was sobbing all over the stage, and everyone looked at him, not knowing what to do, and then he spoke. Help me. Please. Help me. Was all I could make out, and then he vomited and suddenly collapsed. And lights all came down, and we saw the cast. They were all dead. Every one of them looked exactly like the little boy. Every one had those strings attached, and we watched as all of them, even the little boy, as their strings were pulled on. Their lifeless bodies rose on cue. And they bowed. However, we cannot be certain that this is a credible account, but unfortunately it's all we have to work with. The Puppet Master's regime sparked horrible debate among the theater companies. Several audience members had to be treated to special therapy for years to come, and the show itself was covered up by the police. For several years to come, the theater company as well as the police department, that never managed to solve the gruesome murders of the cast of the show denied that the play ever existed. However, in recent years, the stories resurfaced, sparking much new debate on the subject. The theater that housed the show still refuses to acknowledge the show's existence, and most theater historians know nothing about the show in general. To this day, the identities of the anonymous lyrics and music writers are unknown, and all copies of the recordings of the songs and police reports have been destroyed. However, through ancient illegal copies of interviews, theater records, we can gather a bit of information on the show. The show itself had its first workshop in London during 1928. One of the show's songs, Get a Puppet, was recorded with vocals by 12-year-old Garris Creeley. However, this recording has been lost and is only available in the black market of the internet. And other than that, no official records that we know of were ever made. Some ancient accounts say that an illegal taping of the final scene of Act One was recorded from backstage. But we can't be certain that this is anything but a rumor. As for any official memorabilia, very little of anything was ever made for the show to be remembered by. Oddly enough, the show was never advertised, yet it somehow was well known enough to have booked tickets for several months to come. And playbills from its premiere night were given out. Most audience members destroyed their copies after seeing the show, but legend has it, around 10 or 12 survived. On another note, over the years, the show has grown a small cult fan base. And here recently, an off-Broadway revival has been scheduled to premiere soon. When I last broached the topic of the 1934 musical, The Puppets Regime, my knowledge was apparently very limited. I had originally believed that all of the audience members who entered the theater on that fateful night were deceased. But I was incorrect. One lone audience member, Alice Corey James, who was 9 years old when her grandparents took her to see the show, lives in Connecticut with her grandchildren. I garnered this information after my long investigation as to the theater which housed the unfortunate events of 1934. I found myself on a wild goose chase after a long time of theater owners shoving me in different directions via emails or the rare private meeting. I was eventually given the home address of the little old man who shall go unnamed. This man had worked in several theaters over the past 50 or so years and had collected many borrowed theater items. One of these items was a box labeled 34 Creeley Wright. Now, the gentleman claimed that he'd found it in the vaults of the August Wilson Theater, but I'm not sure if he can be trusted, as his eggs seem to be in quite a few baskets, if you understand me. The oddly numbered box contained several sloppily organized papers, all of which detail the long-awaited production of the Puppet Master's Regime. The most interesting of these files was a bulky folder that detailed the 1928 workshop in London, where the title of the show was originally Morator's Friends, which was later changed to Morator's Puppet. As music was refined, however, the title became The Puppet Dressed in Black, and finally changed to Puppet Master, which was the title they used during the actual stage readings. The folder also contained a partial script for the show, although many pages appeared to be missing. None of the song lyrics were shown on the script, although the song titles were printed in their place, along with notes
from the young actor playing the part of Morator. Most of the notes were from the director, a man named Richard Weber, but one particular note seemed a bit ominous. A little less vibrato in this one, Garrus. Make me proud. Make us both proud. Mr. Sheridan. Now, this Mr. Sheridan never showed up on any other files. He may have been an unaccredited assistant director, but something along his handwriting didn't sit right with me. Anyhow, some of the song titles are rather fascinating. Tunes with such titles as Never Mind Me, Mister, or Morator Was an Orphan, and Get a Puppet make the production seem like any other. And the characters don't seem to be written in any strange way, most to my disappointment. It seems like a harmless little kiddie show, cutesy and upbeat. However, as the script progresses, the notes from Mr. Sheridan become more evident, and his messages become increasingly disturbing. We love it the way you used to do it. Stop doing what we never told you to try. Your cheeks puffed out at the end of this number, Garrus. I love it. He loves it. We both love it. They love it. Meet me backstage after the reading, Garrus. He has a gift for you. Meet us backstage, Garrus. They love to look at you. Never leave, Garrus. You're too important to Puppet Master. After reading up to the scene where Morator and his friends try to sell dolls, creatively titled The Doll Selling Song, I decided to stop reading and do a bit of research on Garrus Creeley. I wasn't prepared for the sickening results. Garrus Creeley was born on November 3rd, 1916. His mother had been a vaudeville stripteaser who lacked the funds necessary to support a child. As a result, he was taken in as a three-year-old by a man whose last name was Sheridan. His first name is recorded differently in many documents, and most people believe that it was either Carmichael or Charles, but Sheridan was apparently a Coney Island architect who designed elaborate fun houses and carnival houses. He was also a private composer. He had written many vaudeville numbers and Coney Island themes, and Garrus Creeley Sheridan was a semi-popular vaudeville performer in 1921 to 1923, upon which he was removed from the Sheridan home after Garrus claimed to have been sexually abused by his adoptive father. Garrus was taken to live with Annabel and Henry McGregor, a middle-class family living in Upper Manhattan. Annabel and Henry, in an attempt to rid him of his childhood trauma, relocated to Worcester, England, with Henry McGregor's relatives. Coincidentally, Puppet Master began rehearsals for the workshop a year after Garrus Creeley moved to England. The music and lyrics were still accredited with Anonymous. Now, one might assume that this is just another depressing backstory to a child performer from early 1900s, but it gets worse. Sheridan, along with being an architect and composer, was also a great patron of child pornography. He was the leader of a small group of individuals who specialized in the production of such articles. What makes this more revolting is that from 1921 to 1923, the years that Creeley was his legal son, Sheridan housed a child-centered burlesque theater / brothel underneath his estate. In 1924, he was placed in Danvers State Lunatic Asylum in Massachusetts and escaped in 1926, a year before rehearsal began for the Puppet Master. Now returning to the script for Puppet Master, we actually have a tangible record for both the end of Act 1 as well as most of Act 2. The actual ending of Act 1, as it was written, was such. Morator and his friends design a puppet exactly like the one that Morator had seen in his dreams. That was explained in a song entitled The Puppet Dressed in Black, which I assume was cut in the Broadway production. Now this puppet then comes to life and calls upon his magic powers to send Morator and his friends into a parallel universe. Act 2 begins with Morator finding his friends, as well as Mr. Officer, to be asleep and dangling from puppet strings. And the musical takes more The musical takes a more operatic theme, as we have six songs that are played one after the other without a single interval of speech. The song titles beginning, "Never Mind Me, Mister," reprise, "I can hear them sing. What is this place?" Morator's soliloquy, wooden dolls, and the wind and the whisperings. After this, Morator is confronted by the old man in black from the first act, who, in a long monologue, explains Morator's deep, passionate sexual longings. Morator realizes his clandestine emotions in a song entitled "Beautiful Music," in which the man and Morator apparently fall spontaneously in love. And right before they allude to the thought of intercourse, the puppet dressed in black appears, jealous of Morator's affections. Morator strips naked in front of the puppet, allowing for the wooden demon to seduce him. Morator offers his soul in return for the puppet, releasing the ones closest to him. And when the children and Mr. Obscur are returned, the puppet dressed in black and the old man reveal their sole motivations to punish the little children who repress the nature of their sexual responsibilities. And they explain this in what would eventually become the show's title song, "The Puppet Master's Regime." Then, in a spout of randomness, the puppet's face turns bright red and he shoves Morator into a bed shaped like a hand. In the epilogue, we see that Morator's friends have all been returned to the puppet shop, but none of them remember anything about him. As you would assume, the workshop didn't do well at all, and anybody with half a brain can understand why a musical about why children are obligated to have sex with adults and the puppets wouldn't work now, let alone in 1928. It was met with such a terrible response that the authorities forced the workshop to shut down, classifying it as a child sex tourism. Garris Creeley was temporarily removed from the McGregor household for their approval for allowing him to participate in the production, when in reality the cast members were contradictorily obligated to never speak about the show to anyone outside the production. A week after Garris returned to the McGregors, he was kidnapped from his bedroom, and this all happened the day before his birthday. After 2 days, the authorities found Garris at the theater that had been holding the workshops. He was found in the basement of the theater, tied to a bed with Sheridan. Sheridan, of course, was taken into police custody, where he died 2 days later of a lung infection. However, the most disturbing part about the crime scene was described by Officer James Cartwright. "We broke through the door, and we all fumbled down the stairs. We could hear him," Creeley, "screaming, and we charged into the bedroom and saw puppets. Puppets everywhere, all of them made to look exactly like the little Creeley fellow. There had to be dozens of them all over the room. Some of them were neatly dressed like little dolls. Others didn't have any clothes on at all. It was so disgusting. I felt sick just thinking about it." Along with the recorded 76 Garris Creeley-esque puppets that had been found underneath the theater, authorities found several articles of the occult in Sheridan's makeshift apartment. He had apparently begun to worship an ancient god called Podominus, a dark spirit who controlled all of life within invisible puppet strings. And most of the investigators believe that Sheridan had created this god himself, using the surplus of insanity that he had retained by the time of his death. They found a 5,026-page novel that Sheridan had written over the course of the past 9 years entitled Puppets. It was an extended manuscript version of Puppet Master. It was centered around the character of Morator Abensance, a character obviously based around Garris Creeley. Following the events of the Puppet Master, the McGregors admitted Garris Creeley to the West Riding Mental Hospital, known as Hyroids Hospital, in order to repair his obvious mental damage. He was supervised by his adoptive uncle, Dr. Gregory McGregor, who was personally documented in his progression of 1928 to 1932, when he was released. Other than the folder containing the information from the 1928 workshop, most of the documents presented in the box 34 Creeley Wright were mass jumbles of different documents, everything from vague police reports to scratching reviews of the workshop, and none of them are in any particular order. The only valuable document I've managed to find is a list containing the names of all the audience members who attended in 1934. Seeing as how Alice Corley James is still alive and was seated in the fourth row of the theater, I hope to contact her soon in order to continue my investigation.
From the personal diary of Annabelle McGregor. The 7th of January, 1932. Garris came home today. He seemed paler than he used to. Much more quiet. I wish there was something I could do. I wish I could bring him back to us. But he's gone. I have to accept that. We all have to. As it turns out, the diary of Annabelle McGregor, Garris Creeley's adoptive mother, for those of you who don't remember, was used in the writing of a 1998 psychological thesis by Catherine Jacobs entitled From Garris to Hannah, a study as to the effects of child molestation. In this book, the author uses materials from various different child molestation trials to form an in-depth study on the resulting mental scars such experiences can procure in children. Annabelle's entries themselves aren't that relevant, often repeating the same thing over and over, but they do form a cohesive thread between two big events in Garris Creeley's life: his release from the West Riding Mental Hospital and his journey back to America. According to Annabelle McGregor, 19-year-old Garris Creeley left his parents a week after returning to them, going off to work in a shoe factory. And after being fired for inability to follow proper safety instruction, he worked as an assistant ballet instructor in London. 6 weeks after this, he returned to his parents, where he learned that they had been harboring a secret from him. After Sheridan, his previous adoptive father, had died, Garris was left to inherit all of his belongings. This included the expansive novel Puppets, and the script and score for Puppet Master, the musical version of the same novel. From the personal diary of Annabelle McGregor. 18th of September, 1932. Garris called to tell us that he was leaving. We asked when he was coming home. He hung up after that. It's been 4 days, and I'm beginning to believe that I won't see him ever again. Not much is known about Garris Creeley after that. The next existing record of him is in a financial statement in 1933 concerning an inquiry for a choreographer for the Puppet Master's regime. It would appear that Garris was continuing his adoptive father's work. Why on earth Garris Creeley would drop everything in his life to continue the work of his parental rapist is beyond all logical comprehension. One reason could be that he wanted to understand his father more. He was, after all, Sheridan's son. Perhaps he understood how much Puppet Master had meant to him, and he had devoted himself to polishing up the production. In Catherine Jacobs' book, she details a great many examples of this. In the letter from Garris to the aforementioned choreographer, he writes, "I hope to enliven the production with a bit of playful mystery, such as the essence of the original novel format. I don't have the complete manuscript for Puppets, though Catherine Jacobs apparently does own a small snippet of about 200 pages, God only knows how she acquired it. She lists a total of 17 excerpts in her book, from what I've read. The prose of Puppets is very difficult to understand. One might assume that Sheridan hadn't ever stopped writing it, and had never revised. The story itself follows the main character, Morator, as he goes off on an adventure to explore his own sexual agenda upon the request of a puppet that he meets in a dream. To get a feel for the odd, flowery nature of the writing, here's an excerpt. The puppet was as black as night upon the cold winter eve of Lammastide. Light and airy, yet weak and bitterly sharp. Upon sensing the figure's wooden presence, he scattered himself about the room, unable to find a proper door or window to relieve his urge to escape the angry monstrosity. His eyes danced along the riverway of contempt, stealing glances of the form that beckoned for him to remain motionless. Defeated, he rested himself within his own terror, bending as he slipped into his remorse and fear. I have nothing to work on but the vague points provided by Miss Jacobs for this assumption, but I gather that Garrus used his inheritance to fund the production of the puppet master's regime. In the box 34 Creeley Wright, I found a small folder full of production notes from Garrus that I had glossed over in my previous search. Nothing of great importance stands out other than the pitch Creeley used to gain attention of several theater owners who were interested in housing the production. In this, Garrus describes the show as upbeat, fraught with flowery production numbers, and a moral all ages can relate to. I feel like this is a good time to bring up my meeting with Miss Alice Corley James. I made sure to phone her grandchildren for permission to visit, for which I was declined 3 times. After I sent the cake, they understood my presence, and I was granted access. It was a 6-hour drive to the home of Alice Corley James. Her granddaughter was hospitable enough, well, as hospitable as someone can be when they obviously don't want you in their house. She took me to the living room and offered me some cake, which I declined. A few minutes later, I met Alice, who limped her way onto the couch with a plate of cake in her hand. I tried speaking with her, but she refused to talk to me until she had finished eating. I took an instant liking to the old bat, nutty as she was. Throughout the following Q&A, Alice made it very apparent that she had reviewed her facts, and they seemed rehearsed and tired coming from her lips, but I didn't think much of it. From the Testament of Alice Corley James, 1926 to present. How old were you when you saw the puppet master's regime? 9. I had just turned 9 that Wednesday, and we were going to have a party the following Saturday. What do you remember about the production? I don't truly remember a lot about the show. I was young, I was hyperactive, and I was bored. Bored to tears by the entire thing. It was so very monotonous and so blandly staged. I recall watching the 3 kiddies dancing the exact same motion, twist, tap, for almost 4 minutes. All while the ensemble walked in crisp lines. It was so awkward. That little boy playing the main character, Maury something or other, was a bit quiet, if you asked me. He sort of mumble-spoke, squinting the entire show. Those vague, squinty eyes were bland, too. I fell asleep halfway through Act 1. And do you remember the end of Act 1? No. When I woke up, my parents were dragging me out of the theater. I spent the next 3 hours waiting by the street with my mother while my father searched for his brother. Our Uncle Devin was the assistant choreographer, you see. He died backstage. I think a lift collapsed. I don't know. It was only when I was 30 did they actually tell me what happened. Though I remember that they never acted the same again. Did your uncle keep any documentation of his time working on the production? I wouldn't know. We weren't all that close to him, you see. If he did, where could I find those documents? Well, either they're still at the theater, or... My father... Oh, yes. My father probably had them. I remember the policeman delivering a box to us. Your best chance of finding it would be in the attic. We moved all of my father's old office documents into a red... Yes, it was red. A red chest. If it wasn't there, it was most likely thrown away. Mrs. James's granddaughter aided me in my search, and together we found the red chest, as well as Devin Corley's belongings. They had been shoved into a small storage crate within the chest, sloppily strewn in wrinkled chunks of paper. I offered Alice the opportunity to rifle through the crate, but she politely shooed me out of the house before asking for another piece of cake. At first, I couldn't make much sense of the contents within the box. There are a few bills, some production notes, a list of ensemble performers. However, one particular sheet of paper does catch my interest. The audition notes for the role of Morator. For those of you who don't remember, this was the character whose actor was last seen begging the audience to help him on the night of the Puppet Master's premiere. Not many names are found in this file, oddly enough. Just 14 boys and 6 girls. Underneath the various names are notes over the auditions. Notes that say, too cheeky, too quiet, too mumble-mouthed. But about 3/4 into the paper, the name Timmy Wright is circled 3 times, a small star etched beside it. He's the one. The note read boldly. I've done a bit of research on this performer as well. Timothy Cartwright was born in August 16th of 1923. His father, Vincent Cartwright, was a lighting designer for a theater on Broadway. His wife, Margie, was a costume designer, though little is known about the beginning of Timothy's career. But by the age of 9, he had taken the vaudeville world by storm. As Timothy Cutie Pie Wright, or Cutie Wright for short. As far as I can gather, his only Broadway credit before the Puppet Master's regime was in a semi-successful flop called Joyful Hooligans, in which he played a young British boy who falls off a ship and is taken in by a band of American teenage pickpockets. Devin Corley's diary details the arrival of Timmy to the theater. He says that Timmy was asked to be dropped off in the lobby without his parents. Garris Creeley instructed the staff not to enter the lobby for an hour. At the end of this hour, Garris Creeley himself came through the lobby doors and found Timmy still in his seat by the reception desk. He was quoted to have looked confused and scared, with a look in his eyes that likened to an old cat, weak and defenseless. Garris led him back to his office, where he waited for his parents to return to sign the paperwork. The next few entries of Dennis Corley's diary describe the hiring of the rest of the cast and crew. Shirley Taxim was signed on to play Trahunt for 3 weeks, died in an automobile accident, and was replaced by Sally Wilkes. Henry Gregory, another vaudeville performer who had worked with Timmy at least twice before, was signed on to play Oddlebit. Other cast members, including Fernando Perrin as Mr. Obscur and Grace Day as Madame Reperio. A casting for the man in black, as well as the puppet dressed in black, are not listed. Set design was done by Abraham Durate, and costumes were done by Julianne White. Lighting and direction was taken up by Garris Creeley himself. For the first 2 weeks of production, Dennis Corley's description of Creeley doesn't seem too interesting. A bit eccentric, a bit of a perfectionist, but he's also described as jolly and surreal, like the Santa impersonators that you see at the department stores. He was always cracking jokes, and for the most part, he had a good attitude. However, as innocent as his behavior seemed, even from the beginning, he has a strange obsession with Timothy Wright. Coily details an instance where Timothy was clearly getting the choreography wrong, and yet, Garrus berates the other children for messing him up. From Dennis Corley's perspective, he coddles the boy and barely even directs him. Now, as lighthearted as he was, Garrus Creeley was also a rather strict director. Devin Corley claims that each of the cast members was to arrive at 4 in the morning, 2 hours before crew arrived, simply for vocal exercises and warm-ups. One entry states, the ensemble was placed into 3 lines, and the children were lined up in front. Mr. Creeley would spend 15 minutes going over the exact same tap routines each morning. He always had Timmy do it first, then the others were to follow. Afterwards, everyone was to gather in a circle for vocal warm-ups. He would start by going through the ranges. Then Garrus had us do that awful dance. There were to be 2 circles, one inside the other, and the cast would hold hands. Then both circles were to dance around in opposite directions. The outer circle began to chant first, crying out, Simmental, Simmental, while the inner circle yelled out, Freyla, Freyla. Both chants were ensemble vocals that had been cut from the production, but Mr. Creeley saw fit to include them every morning, saying that they were perfect vocal warm-ups. Garrus's impatience continues throughout the rehearsal. He grows violent, and more cast members report to Darren that Sally Wilkes exhibited bruises on her upper arm. The script was modified weekly, putting the company in great stress. Timmy Wright was the one who took most of the damage, as most of the changes gave his character more lines, placing him under a lot of pressure. He was often asked to visit Creeley's office for private readings, where he'd stay for hours. Tragedy enters the life of Timothy Cartwright on August 13, 1933, when he and his family had been the victims of an automobile accident which killed his father and severely injured both his mother and he. Tevin writes that for a month and a half, Garrus visited Timothy daily and eventually stopped coming to rehearsal altogether. The principal choreographer, Mandis Thorman, took up the role of director during that time. It was also during that time that they sought out the employment of 14-year-old Rory Atkins to be the understudy for Timmy. Devin writes that it was at the conspiring of Thorman and the producers that Rory would eventually replace Timmy. This cute Wright, writes one producer, is completely inept in the art of performance. His delivery is too big, his eyes are too big, his presence is too big, and for all that bigness, he has a shockingly little amount of talent and discipline. Mr. Creeley spoils the boy and hardly gives a scrap of motivational honesty in the direction of anyone else. In short, Timothy Cartwright must go. While Garrus Creeley was gone, the production staff also persisted in cutting certain things from the show. This included a number that occurred midway through Act 2. A gibberish number sang by an army of puppets that they say slowed down the production. Creeley was quite unhappy with this, giving them several angry phone calls about the matter, and they eventually gave him an ultimatum, cut the number completely or put it somewhere else. Garrus placed it at the end of Act 1. Devin notes that Garrus would tell the children to practice this number on their own time, and when they did run through it during rehearsals, it was in segments, never in its entirety. The number itself contained one group of lyrics that was repeated over and over again. Garrus made it painfully clear that the company has to sing these stanzas exactly 100 times before they could take a break during the intermission, even if the curtains had closed before they were finished. Devin's journal ends with a relief from notes throughout. Instead, he explains an event that he himself was present for. I think it's best to probably just read the section itself. Nobody was ever allowed in Mr. Creeley's office but Mr. Creeley and Timmy. I assumed Mr. Creeley would want to meet Rory, but never asked for an audition with him. However, Mandis had instructed me to deliver 3 resignation letters to Mr. Creeley's desk, and I went to my task. When I came in, the room was all must and hot, like there wasn't even air conditioning in there. The windows were down, but my vision adapted fairly quickly. I saw that on the floor was a worn mattress with plates and cups all around. I blinked in surprise. Rushing over to the bedding, I saw that it had definitely been in use for quite a while. I wondered in astonishment if Mr. Creeley had been living in the theater. And when I considered the idea, I did recall that he'd put all of his money into this show, and we never heard him ask us to send papers to his house. Only his office. Along the far end of the room were a few piles of shirts and trousers. It was still very dark, so I didn't focus on them too much. I went to set the papers down on the desk when, against my better judgment, I had the urge to snoop around a bit. I looked over the top of the desk. Nothing but pens and scrambled folders. Then went right to the corner drawer. What was inside the drawer frightens me more now than it did when I saw them. Within the drawer was a gun. A bit eccentric, maybe, but I thought nothing of it. As well as a worn, hand-painted mask. Red in color, it was put into a shape of a doll's face. A puppet's. Beside the mask was a small journal. I opened it and found the pages to be yellowed with age. The pages themselves concealed mad writings that were barely legible, but I could tell by the drawing that it was some sort of worshipper's guide. There were these charcoal sketches of a puppet, a giant puppet, that controlled the world on strings protruding from its fingernails. Other pictures showed the puppet walking amongst common men who couldn't see it. There was a man stroking the bodies of his wife and children, a young girl being brought for the night by an older gentleman, 2 twins being held down on their bed by some invisible force, all pictures in which the puppet stood by, grinning. I placed the journal back into the drawer, but then I noticed the mask. The mask had the same face that the puppet had. An insane grin, wide eyes, puffy cheeks. It was only when I held it closer to my face did I notice it also shared the features of Timmy. The same mouth, the same nose, the same eyes. I shoved the mask back into the drawer and shut it quickly. My curiosity morphed into sickness. I backed away from the desk and hit the wall. Turning to my right, I felt my right foot come into contact with the pile of clothes that I saw earlier. My eyes had completely adjusted to the dark by now, and I could see that not all of the shirts and trousers were in Mr. Creeley's size. At least 4 of them were smaller. The clothes a young boy would wear. I grabbed the papers off the desk and ran out. I delivered them to Mr. Creeley's hand that afternoon. And after that, there are 7 pages blank in the journal of Devin Corley. There are no more entries. At the bottom of this crate, however, was a newspaper dated October 3rd, 1935. The headline reads, "Flower Shop Vandal Strikes Again." And on the 3rd page is a small section dedicated to the disaster that occurred at the August Wilson Theater on October 1st. Oddly enough, the article doesn't mention the Puppet Master's regime by name more than once, but it focuses on the aftermath. In an interview, the police officer Jeremy Winthrop, "We ain't got no idea what could have happened. We got a call from a diner down the street talking about some riot going down at the August Wilson. We came to find a bunch of theatergoers crying and begging for help. They just kept saying, "They're dead. They're dead. They're really dead." We went inside, but we didn't find nothing. You see, 76 attendants of the 1935 showing went missing. 98 if you count the theater company, whose bodies were never recovered from the stage, though many testified to have seen them die. Others claimed to have seen people collapsing in the aisles. When the police investigated the theater, they saw that one of the lifts backstage had collapsed, but there were no traces of anyone there. The only bodies recovered was that of Garris Creeley. He had been found in his office, a bullet in his head. Other than that, nothing. No blood, no struggles. Those 98 people were never seen again. After that, there's nothing left in the crate but barely visible photos of cast members and fabric samples of costumes. At this point, my investigation to the Puppet Master's regime ended. Or at least, the historical investigation. Do you remember the revival of the Puppet Master that I mentioned at my first entry? Well, the first preview performance will take place in Chicago on September 18th. I've already booked balcony seats. Being a full-time investigator for an obscure, pornographic musical doesn't lend itself to much of an earning, you see. And I'll be attending the showing where I'll record the audio, take notes on the production, and I'll do a detailed run-through of the production the day after I see it. Investigation will resume September 18th. Update. September 20th. Alright, I never got around to posting the previous investigation. I know, it was irresponsible, but during my wait for Puppet Master, I started actually paying attention to my college courses. And I never really had time to revise my first draft. So I suppose I'll just have to post my findings in one long entry, as I've seen the revival of Puppet Master. The experience was odd. It's hard to remember the things that went wrong until I run through the entire thing in my head. It's easier to write about the first act in that way, I guess. I know that doesn't really make sense when you put it to words, but it's hard to explain, but enough of my cryptic buildup. I arrived in Chicago last week, where I stayed with a couple of old high school friends for a few days. We had fun catching up, but I never took my mind off of the Puppet Master's regime. The theater that housed the production was rather obscure, located a few miles out from the main city, and none of the news articles that I've read post-preview have mentioned the name of that theater, so I can only imagine that they don't want the publicity. Upon entering the theater, I was given a playbill by a cheery man in a suit. An older gentleman with a weak smile on his face. The playbill itself showed the white silhouette of a young boy, several puppet strings attached to a scribbly red and black heart that hung within his chest. There were white dollies hanging all around him. I remember thinking that it was odd that a preview playbill would be in color, as those usually aren't printed until the show starts making money. Well, anyway, I made it to my seat and began to read through the playbill itself. I didn't much care about the names of the cast members, though I do recall seeing the pictures for a boy playing the part of Marader, a 14-year-old named Milton Holiday. And the show opened to a long, plodding overture, played mostly with piano, with these odd whistles being played through the speakers all around the theater. And after about 5 minutes, the music changed to a more bouncy, lighthearted tune. And the curtain came up. The stage was empty. Nothing but the projected backdrop of a village square, with these old clouds floating above, about 10 children in 18th century Germany clothing skipped on stage, playing with balloons and dolls. As the music progressed, a small mechanical horse wheeled its way on stage. The lights dimmed, and the children stopped. The horse dragged along a cart upon which a small curtained puppet box faced the audience. As the cart came to a stop, a large puppet in a black robe flew out from behind the curtain, and the children screamed and backed away. And then the puppet spoke. "Good day, little ones. What a wondrous day for a bout of play, isn't it? Now don't you be frightened, sweetlings. The puppet dressed in black has a tale to weave, and someone has to hear it. Why, even if a story isn't terribly uplifting, it's the relevance of the story that matters, isn't it? Now gather. Gather, my popinjays. For this story, I'm afraid, requires the keen ears of a curious child. For only the innocent can see things simply, without the distractions of growth." The children looked at each other, then slowly began to gather around the cart. Once they were all seated, the puppet let out a chilling laugh. "That's the spirit, kiddies," he sings spoke. "Now this is a story about many things, about love and hate, about dark and light, about the difference between right and wrong, and the difference between wrong and right. But at the core, this is a story about a little boy named Marader." And with that, the light on the cart fades away, and a light fades in on a small boy holding a broom, smiling proudly. Marader. The rest of the prologue is rather bland, and I can't remember or decipher the audio to much of the exposition. The puppet, Marader, and Mr. Obisker share a song. We learn that Marader was an orphan who Mr. Obisker found on the side of the street 5 years ago, and has since put him to work in his puppet shop. The costumes from this point seem much less historically accurate from the opening scene. Everyone's costumes seem faded and bland in color scheme, but each of the outfits are ridiculously frilly and layered. Some of the story's exposition is changed. For example, Marader's last name, Obisance, has been reapplied from the novel on which the story was based. The staging and set design is oddly reminiscent of Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Woman in White. Most of the sets are made up of hyper-realistic projections that give the illusion of a moving camera. However, unlike The Woman in White, there are far more set pieces which actually have moving images projected on them, like the revival of Sunday in the Park with George. For example, during one of the opening songs, I can hear them whisper. We see Marader sweep up along the puppet shop. We watch as the front desk and two puppet display shelves spin around on the turntable as the projected background spins slightly faster, adding in ominous shadows and subtle lighting changes. It was dizzying, but effective. Most of the Act 1's exposition seemed rather harmless, in my opinion. It almost seems like the start of a Disney show. However, I did find my inner critic rolling his eyes at some of the lyrics, my personal favorite being, "He pretended he was crying, though they told me he was lying, and he's a sickly boy, knowing not of joy." However, upon comparing the new version to what I've heard about with the other two, there are some significant changes to the show. For example, the character of Madame Rapario has been cut completely. After the cutesy song Get a Puppet, we are taken to the center of the village. And here we have one of the songs that had been cut in the previous version, entitled Whittle Time, in which the villagers celebrate a holiday of the same name. The celebration focuses on villagers dancing around with a puppet doll made out of random objects such as twigs, scraps, and clothing, and cornstalks. The music is charming, like a folk song, although the lyrics don't seem to make much sense. Dancing as we pither, though the wilting and woe, evermore aligned along the ever-growing row, eyes without a trace of tone or livelihood, and so rise and rejoice for a whittletine song, and the willows will wander all whittletine long. Here, the song where the children sell dolls is used as a bridge in the whittletine sequence. Another change is the rearranging of the Wind and Whisperings, a song that was originally played in Act 2. In this new version, it's sung monotonously by a group of black-clad people mourning the loss of a young girl, a rape victim. The sequence itself is it's so strange. Around 8 people walk on stage, 4 of them carrying a small open coffin, and the lighting goes from yellow-orange to blue. And the chorus drones on for about 8 minutes as they somewhat explain how the girl died. The wind was her muse for play, and she pranced along the riverway. She slipped along the sides of the weeping willow's hairs, and she danced along the riverway with narrow a remorse. The whisperings from far away, calling out for her to stay. She stayed there with the wind and the whisperings of yore, and she danced with him until he saw fit to take her source. Again, this uncomfortable ensemble song goes on for about 8 minutes, from what I could assume the little girl had been playing along the river when a man asked her to stay with him until nighttime, where he tied her down before a policeman stopped him right as the girl had perished. Other than that, most of Act 1 seemed the same as the other versions, given there is a small bit where a girl with a puppet mysteriously appears and disappears while Morator sweeps up the shop, and a random scene right before the finale in which Mr. Abascar sings about the hardships of raising Morator, a song reworked from the same song Madame Rapario sang in 1934. The finale song itself, which so many people had claimed held some sort of force to it in the 1934 production, didn't seem all that powerful. Though this may be due to a rewrite. The 1934 version was said to be significantly longer than the 1928 workshop, and at around 12 minutes of non-stop gibberish lyrics, the version had a reprise of the Wind and the Whisperings, followed by a few verses told through the old language. The lyrics are in fact somewhat odd-sounding after 2 minutes of non-stop strobe lighting, but I wasn't that affected by it. There weren't any deaths after the finale, at least. Though, intermission did last 10 minutes longer than it was supposed to due to technical difficulties backstage. Act 2 was where most of the changes seemed to be. It began with a light on Morator being strung up on ropes like a puppet, his friends and Mr. Abascar hanging on each side of him. A new song plays, where all the songs from Act 1 are placed into a montage, while the Act 1 finale music plays in the background. And just as the music shifts to the pounding whittletime music, Morator awakens. And remember when I mentioned that Act 2 was mostly made up of a bunch of songs played one after the other for no apparent reason? Most of that's been cut. The only two songs from that long, drawn-out sequence are What Is This Place? And Morator's Soliloquy, which has been renamed to Morator Confronts the Puppet. and has been changed to a duet sequence. The lyrics have been improved. Whereas the 1934 show had lyrics such as this. What is this place? What are you aiming? This isn't well, sir. Why are we gaming? This isn't a game. The improved lyrics are, what is this place? Wait, am I dreaming? This isn't real, no. Nor what it's seeming. It's all a dream. It's still a little clunky, but at least they make sense now. And the particular scenes that I listed before involved a panicking Marauder confronting the puppet dressed in black, who explains that Marauder's soul once belonged to a child rapist, and that he died before the puppet could punish him. This is where the set design becomes a bit odd. There were several floor-to-ceiling metal dollies that would constantly roll about on stage as if to symbolize Marauder walking somewhere, and the backdrop went red, and there were projections of puppets flinging the corpses of children along the walls. To say it was unsettling would be an understatement. After this, the story progresses in a similar manner as the 1928 workshop, but with different twists. Marauder learns that the odd-looking man in black from the first act was the boy that Marauder raped in the past life. The man in black wants to revisit their relationship, but Marauder wants nothing to do with him. They spend the next 10 minutes singing about what might have been, and Marauder begins to remember things. He ends up seducing and dominating the man in black, while a group of children acrobats frolic along the long sheets of fabric above them. And just then, the puppet dressed in black shows up and orders the old man to go away. He explains to Marauder that his punishment is to forever serve him, aiding in the future murder of children in the village where he lives. As they both sing the title song, several children, including the little girl who drowned in Act 1, join in, all holding miniature puppets dressed in black. The new ending is a bit confusing, but apparently they're saying that pedophilia is some sort of vicious cycle. When one dies, his soul is placed into that of a newborn child who will, by fate, become one themselves. This influences them to be. Marauder, as well as several other children, manage to defy destiny by escaping their respective rapists, which results in their being enlisted into the puppet master's regime. It makes so little sense, and it's so damn creepy. Then, just like in the 1928 workshop, all of Marauder's friends are returned to the puppet shop. But none of them have any memory of Marauder. We cut back to the cart from the prologue, where we see all the children have disappeared, and from the back of the puppet box, Marauder and the man in black exit from behind the curtains. They hop upon the horse and begin to trot their way out of town. As they exit the village, they hear a small girl's terrified screams. She lunges out in front of the cart. She begins to beg Marauder and the man to help her, and just as the old man rushes out in pursuit, he insists that he is the girl's father. But she sobs that she's never met him before. Panicked, Marauder pulls on the horse reins and runs over the man, killing him. And the man in black turns to Marauder, and his voice low whispers, Marauder, what have you done? Before the lights go out. However, right after this scene is where things quickly became wrong. The lights slowly fade up from the green tint of the forest into a deep blue, similar to the lighting during the wind and the whispering. The entire company slips out from backstage holding their miniature puppets, staring directly at the audience. And just then, the lights begin to flash and the puppets. And I know this sounds kind of stupid to say, but they sang. I don't mean that the children sang while controlling the puppets' mouths, the puppets. They actually sang. And oh god, the song. It was the same gibberish from the Act 1 finale. The children, the adults, all of them were holding puppets. They chanted those horrible words over and over again, their eyes unblinking, focused on the audience, trapped in our own seats, We were forced to listen to the song repeat itself over and over, and I saw that the cast had begun to move the puppets around in jerking, near-erotic dance moves, and every now and again twitching in unison with the rest of the company. And after a while, I began to feel sick. We were all sick. I could see people in front of me leave their seats, ready to leave. I tried tuning the chants out, but that only seemed to make them worse. The music pounded within me, causing me to jerk about with each pounding drum. As if I reached back in my seat, I realized something. The pounding within me wasn't just from the orchestra. It was from beneath me. For a moment, I could see that everyone else could see it too. For a faint moment, we could feel the ground beneath us quake along with the chants. I looked up to see if the cast had noticed, but then I saw the puppets. They were still dancing and moving within their performers' grasps, but the performers themselves were not moving their arms. And then for a moment, we all found relief. From backstage, several crew members rushed on the stage, pushing several actors away in the process, and one of them screamed out, "Fire! Shit!" And then the chaos began. From above the stage, all the lights began to shoot off. The projections behind the actors flickered briefly before shutting off entirely, and the company screamed, as did the audience. In a flash of fire and sparks, the actors began to leap off stage, and we all began to pile out the door. I still had a headache. I could still hear the pounding. The fire department arrived shortly after the theater was evacuated. About 10 minutes before the trucks arrived, we heard the back of the theater collapse. I've since checked the articles online, and 60-plus attendants of that show, 9 of them being the cast and crew, have gone missing. As it turned out, most of the people who didn't leave the parking lot were either helping out, like me, or were too shaken up to drive. And when I finally began to walk towards my car, a gurney was wheeled right past me. The man that I saw laying there unconscious and hooked up to an oxygen tank was the same man who handed me the playbill. I drove back to my friend's apartment and went straight to bed. Even in my sleep, I could still hear the pounding. By morning, my headache had stopped, but the memory of the night before still lingered. I went to my computer straight away to upload the audio that I had recorded. My camera tends to divide long videos into smaller ones. And I immediately deleted the last video. Nobody ever needed to hear that, especially not me. I listened to the recording again, making notes in word processor as I went along, and I found myself humming to some of the more bouncy tunes. The pounding slowly fading away. My fear of the show has lessened. The idea of supernatural forces destroying the theater seemed far too ridiculous for me to take seriously, and I brushed the fear aside. Once that was done, I went to work scanning the playbill. And after scanning the front, I went to work scanning the interior pages. A bit curious, I skimmed through some of the production names. It was then, right there, on the third page, I saw the picture of the man who had handed me the playbill. The man was the head producer-director. A cheery old man with a wrinkled face looking away from the camera, and below his picture in bold letters read the name Timothy Cartwright. My face scrunched. My breath went still. All I could hear was the faint memory of the pounding. That isn't right, I told myself. It isn't possible. It's a different person. It had to be. Timothy Cartwright died on October 1st, 1935, at the premiere of The Puppet Master's Regime. Everyone saw it. Everyone saw him begging for help, strung up on strings. This isn't possible. Interview, and then I remembered something. In my interview with Alice Corley James, she mentioned Morator's squinty eyes and his monotonous acting, and Timothy Wright was known for his wide-eyed expressions and over-the-top delivery. It's what made him famous. The person performing Morator that night in 1934 must have been Rory Atkins, the understudy. That and Garris Creeley had been found dead, killed by a gunshot to the head. Everyone assumed that it was suicide. Nobody even suspected murder. I remembered Devon's journal, the puppet's mask, the clothes, the fascination Garris Creeley had with the little cutie Wright, and nobody even suspected murder. Why would they? And then to add to my revelation, I realized that among the cast members who had escaped from the theater, there was one boy seated in the back seat of his mother's car. The vague, empty face of Milton Holiday. Morator. The Puppet Master's Regime is not a simple musical, I've come to realize. It's more than just a production. It's a force, an entity, even. It's not just a madman's sick, elaborate scheme to... It isn't just a young boy's obsession over destroying his father's work. It isn't only an innocent victim's last attempt at showing the world how he was wronged. It's a greater monster than that. And within the writing and music of this show is something... I don't know what, and I don't want to know what. Some kind of monster that refuses to die. And people who saw the Puppet Master's Regime in both 1928 and 1934 were said to have suffered from long-life mental effects, causing them to hum tunes that they had heard only once. And even now, as I type, I quietly hum the sick, demented tune of "Never Mind Me, Mister." And when I sleep, the wind and the whispering refuses to rid itself of my subconscious. I find myself thinking about this production night and day, singing and thinking about possible depths to certain subplots and songs. And what's worse is I know that someday another revival of the demented work will make its way onto stage. Milton Holiday is still alive, isn't he? And this evil won't rest until it remakes itself again. I've decided not to post any more of my findings. This includes the audio taken of my revival, and I suggest that none of you ever attempt to look further into the matter. It simply isn't worth it. A few days after writing this, I read a few articles about the fire at the theater and those 60-plus missing people. The fire department has been searching through the rubble. None of the bodies have been found.